It's time for us to begin this morning. If you want to open your Bibles up to the book of Exodus, we'll dig into our study shortly. Last time Bell accidentally hit, not intentional. Maybe everyone's scurrying to class now with the bell. Let's see. Before we continue our study, let's bow to God in prayer and center our lives into spiritual things. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the privilege that it is to sit in front of the testimony of your plan and design for us. Help us to lift up your word in a manner and form that is understandable to us. Help us to grow by the application of the seed of the message of God. And help us to learn to trust you when we are uncertain of what the future holds. Give us the patience that we need to crawl through the difficulties of each day and learn that that is not enough. Please forgive us of our sins and please watch over us as we serve you, and we pray this in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so in Exodus, we've been broadly looking at the answer to that big question from Exodus chapter 5 and verse 2. That's where Moses approaches Pharaoh, and Pharaoh's response to the request, "Let my people go," is, "Who is the Lord? Why should I hear his voice? In essence, why should I obey you?" And the answers that come as a follow-on include some goals of God in their application, but more principally, they really are answering that question. They're answering it again for Pharaoh. They're answering it for Moses, for Aaron, for Israel, for Egypt. We've shifted from where the plagues that are dropped by the miraculous hand of God are uniform across the region to where more pressure, if you will, is being leveraged on the consequence side to Egypt. And Israel seems to be on the fulcrum point being lifted up. And you can kind of think of those plagues in that regard as well, where here you have Egypt over here. You've got Goshen right here where Israel is, and the lever of God, like a pry bar, is pushed down, and that's the plagues. That's Moses. That's God's handiwork. And he's prying them up, and he does so and puts all the pressure more and more on Egypt, and more principally, right on the edge right here, who's right there? Pharaoh's right there. He is the fulcrum. Moses is probably seeing it all go down, but he's feeling the weight in a different way as well. But that pressure point then is easily seen as the part that hardens the heart of Pharaoh. It helps us kind of understand what's going on there. You kind of see the illustration of the practical side of the work of God in that sense. Now, in looking at what takes place here, we've already had some of these miracles go down. We introduced the next one here in the ninth chapter in our last class, where the plague of Merian, or the big consequence for the livestock goes down. And then we also had the boils. And we made the connection to Job and how awful that experience was, and how Job's own flesh eventually betrayed him, and the suffering and sorrow that came from that. And the response of his friends was to lecture him about his sin rather than to compassionately consider his own sorrows. And so that dialogue takes place, and a little bit of that is seen in some regard in the actions of Pharaoh himself. And then we talked about the hail that is dispensed by God. And that kind of closed out part of our look at the ninth chapter on Wednesday. That's not the end of the plagues, though. That's not the end of the way in which God is working in this process. But it already has brought us to a point of seeing this, the systemic, complete devastation that God is bringing about. And he's demonstrating his superiority in what is in essence a number of ways. Over the small things, over the big things, over man, over beast, over the environment as a whole. What you eventually see in part to part is that there is no part of the land, people, leadership, animal kingdom, plant kingdom, insect kingdom, however you want to phrase it out, that is beyond the reach of Jehovah. Pharaoh thought that Jehovah had no arm to reach into his kingdom, and God's hands, God's arm reaches all the way to the extents of the borders of their kingdom. And so part of that is taking place here when you kind of think about all of the encompassing consequences of that. Then we look at what is the next step, and this is the locusts. I want to take a second before we get into the detail of the text. It's going to be chapter 10 and verses 1 through 20. And think through something. The idea of locusts as a storytelling method of God, because he does use the image after this, comes up often. But they are all in part based on this initial impact on the spiritual level. There are two levels to each of these plagues, again, by the way. And the first one is the physical ramifications. We talk about that a lot. But there's a spiritual side to them as well, whether it's the lever on Pharaoh or whether it's the bigger stories that are being told. But they all kind of, the spiritual ones stem from here. But stop for a second and we'll package the spiritual one in a moment. The physical idea of a plague of insects is not unique to the Bible. It is a consequence that is historical in man's dealing with the creation. Sometimes you have issues like this that would rise up, particularly in these regions, where an infection of bugs would destroy a crop. Does that happen today? Yeah. You know, it can ravage through the cotton crops throughout antiquity. There are certain plants and bugs that are interacting poorly in state parks and in private locations right now that are killing off one another because of an imbalance in the ecosystem, we would say. The predator's gone. Is there a particular vine that was imported from overseas somehow that pretty much owns the South? Everyone knows, right? Well, it's a plague because there's no winning versus kudzu on your own. You know, one man cannot win the fight versus the kudzu. You can if you burn everything down, but then the kudzu seems to come back. It comes back. It's basically the cockroach of the plant world in some way. But understand that that picture is the easy one. To see the devastation done on the physical side. But to understand the spiritual ramification that goes with it then helps us understand the times in the future when God will draw up and show to us a picture of an advancing horde, a plague of insects to describe things like justice, the consequence and devastation that's about to happen to a nation. We see it as, well, that's an image of the army that's surrounding him, and it is. But it's not an army that God is crawling up because it's made by human hands. That usually represents that God is part of the picture. God's spiritual vision of the setting is also coming in. And he often has this idea of clean slating things. Because you have rebelled, we need to clean the slate. Because you have left me, we need to clean the slate. Whether it's taking the remnant out of Israel, bringing them into protection in slavery, captivity, then what's left is left for the locusts. It's left for them to chew up and clean slate. So God lifts up the remnant out, and then the locusts come through and eat the slate clean. That's what they do. There's nothing that stops them. So that's part of the spiritual imagery that will come up. What you can do right now, especially with each of these various plagues, is kind of try to put it in your memory store bank. All these events, when you see in the writings of the prophets, Ezekiel, Joel, you think about about Jeremiah's lamentations and the weeping that comes, some of that comes in here. All the minor prophets, they all hint back to the times in which God's miraculous work has accomplished essentially that levering where God rescued the remnant and then something happened as a consequence afterwards. So you kind of see all of those things. So this imagery there is powerful when we catch it, and I wanted to make sure we take a little bit of time in looking at it right now to stir it up and bring it to the top of the table. Tim?
One of the interesting things about locusts is that you notice that not at the beginning of this, locusts by nature are the ones that are tended to God.
Yeah. You know, they're scavengers in some way compared to others who are, other insects and things, or builders or farmers, in the same way we kind of interact with the environment. Insects have that same roles at different times. More of them are scavengers than builders, but that's not an even, you know, slate there. But they do come through, and they kind of just take what's left. And that major point comes again and again and again, the left for the locusts. You know, we would say left for the crows. That's kind of how we would probably catch a more common illustration to us, because typically locusts aren't our particular plague in this part of the nation. But elsewhere it still is. Still rise up and they still create great storms that cloud their way through. So now into the text, chapter 10. All right, so chapter 10, we're going to start with verses 1 through 6. Roy, do you want to read that for us? You looked up first, you got caught, and I was on this side of the room, so we'll bounce it around a little more. Chapter 10, verses 1 through 6. Nope. I'll stop that problem, too. Stop right there. So, catch a little detail. The hardening of Pharaoh's heart is indicated as part of the necessity of God's plan. It allows him to show the signs for all to see. If you think about again how that text is rendered, this is coming back from the big part of it, verse 1, chapter 10. I've hardened his heart and the heart of his servants that I may show these signs of mine among them. So there's an interwoven aspect to this bigger picture that it's not just A plus B equals C. It's almost like A times B if you look at the mathematical side. They have to go together and they multiply their impact. But also catch this. This is probably the first instance that I caught. If there's not, there's more, I just didn't catch it. Where not only Pharaoh's heart has been hardened. Early on, we see Pharaoh as the despot just telling everyone to do, and they're all following along. But his servants have been hardened now, too. So it's not just Pharaoh. Though the Bible story often emphasizes just who? Pharaoh. Now you begin to understand a little bit more of what's going on when you catch a few extra details, because why then would they all rush to their demise through the Red Sea. Why would they all move this way? Well, if you move back, we'll move back. Our timeline goes this way. That's the official timeline direction. If you go back over to here, it wasn't just Pharaoh who was afraid of Israel. He wasn't the only scaredy cat. They all, in many senses, were. And Pharaoh's solution, as you move forward, was enacted by all of them. They all, let's make it harder on them. If it's harder on them, who is it easier for? We can have our burdens. We can have this, you know, it's easier on them, so it's harder on, okay. Now you move forward. The magicians come in. We look at the magicians and go, charlatans, fakes, liars, right? That's how we look at them. In their world, they're like, money in the bank. I got a job here. I got position. This guy's upsetting the whole circumstance. He's taken that from us. Now why is our heart hardened against it? They don't want to leave. They don't want to lose. They don't want to diminish. Plus, would they want to be exposed openly and publicly to all of Egypt as being frauds? Now do you understand a little bit why their servants might be hardened against what's going on? That's their kind of grumpy attitude. Move a little bit forward. Egypt, still getting the plagues. Israel, not getting the plagues. Early on, everybody, wait a minute. How come they have it so good? We don't have it good. You ever been in that physical space where you see someone else succeed and you're still being punished and you don't understand why? Context doesn't matter. Work, personal life, broadly in the experiences, that's a universal experience. The root of bitterness that rises up looks and says, why not me? And the next step is, I'm better than they are. We don't express it that way. We don't come out and say it that way, but we end up doing those things. And then we maybe, with maturity, go, stop that. You know, you're better than that. And we talk ourselves back down from the ledge. But now we maybe understand a tiny little window into what's going on the other half of the equation. So back to our lever here. When we come in and the next plague is coming down, and after all that's come to pass, the little bit they have left, the little tiny remnants that they had, locusts are going to come and eat that all away. You're a dad, and your family is starving. You're a mom, and your kids have no food. And you know there's food in the slaves' houses. What do you emotionally want to do? Not lawfully, but emotionally. I want to get food for my family. And it's over there. So the hardening of their hearts seems less irrational, less obstinate on the individual level. We do the hard thing. Take off our shoes, put on the Egyptian sandals, kind of shuffle along a little bit. Now, we also have the greater insight to know, hey, wait a minute. We would have walked with God early on, we'd have all our stuff. We wouldn't be in this mess. If we would walk with Israel right now and join them, we'd probably be okay too, but we have a vision that they don't. We have the whole unveiled package. We know the plan of God. We know the bigger picture. And this is history. On this side, that's history. So that's the old experience. So it's facts and record rather than, right now. In verses 7 through 11, we're going to get some of the filler, if you will, to add on to it. Michael, you want to read for us? You got that open? Michael, Tony, I'm going to get designators at some point for each of you. But verses 7 through 11, if you will.
Pharaoh's servant said to him, how long will this man be in fear? Let the men go, that they may serve the Lord their God. Do you not realize that Egypt is destroyed? So Moses and Aaron were brought back to Pharaoh, and he said to him, go, serve the Lord your God. Who are the ones that are going? Moses said, we shall go with our young and our old, with our sons and our daughters, with our flocks
All right, so there's a couple of things that happen here. Someone in the servant side of Pharaoh's court advisory says, listen, Egypt's done for. Why are you doing this? Smartest man in the room right there. At that moment, he became, whoever they were, the wisest person in Egypt. But as is often the case, the wisdom of the wise is despised. Wait a minute, no. We can't have that. The men can go, but you got to leave the women and children here. That, if we go back in time, that means from the Egyptian side, all of their fears are outside of Egypt, and they've just got the weakest part of Egypt in their possession. And so they're okay. No one's going to get us. We're not looking because of the might of the numbers. So that same theme draws up. But that wasn't God's request. His request wasn't, hey, let me negotiate with you. And just, we want to do some worship. Can some of us go? Was that God's approach to the issue? The parallel is really simple. When God is talking to us, He doesn't want half of our heart. He's not negotiating for a portion of our time. It's all or nothing. We don't always move that way, but God is moving to us that way. Because He moves to us with all or nothing. That's exactly how He comes to us. You get it every answer. Or a gulf, a chasm, a distance, a space, and there's nothing. God doesn't want partial obedience. Israel knows that. Pharaoh hasn't caught that. He's still snared. The wisdom of this one wise, individual in the midst of all of that is still there. And again, there's one more thing that comes to pass in this entire dialogue. And that's the providence and protection of God when Moses goes forth. Do you not think that there was someone in the Egyptian army who said, I'm going to be the hero today and kill Moses? What would have, in that perception, what do you think Pharaoh would have given for the head of Moses who brought at his feet? So now think about it. How is Moses surviving this conversation? The level of animosity that exists between Moses, Pharaoh, and Egypt. There's two reasons, by the way, that's likely the case. One of them is the easy one. What's the main reason? Someone's catching that Moses isn't like just some magic street dealer pulling off David Blaine tricks. And so some of that's being caught. But there's one more. That big fear all the way back here. If they make Moses into a martyr, what happens to Israel? Not realistically what you would think Israel would do, but what the fearful Egyptians would think. Uprising. Uprising. There's two factors to think about in this interaction. But the main one, though, is still the hand of God, because he's going into the throne room. We would say he's going into the belly of the beast. Have a conversation. That also helps us understand more of the motivations of Moses' fear, the background there, but it also helps us see his transformation. Because the first time he goes into the belly of the beast and walks out whole, I can do that again. It's still bad, but I can do that again. I can survive that journey. Continuing, this is verses now 12 through 15. Everyone's all looking down all of a sudden. Oh, except for Steve, he's ready to go. Steve, could you read for us? Verses 12 through 15 of chapter 10.
And the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt, so that they may come upon the land, but even in every plant in the land, all that the hail is left. So Moses stretched out his staff over the land of Egypt, and the Lord brought an east wind upon the land all that day and all that night. When it was morning, the east wind had brought the locusts, and the locusts came up over all the land of Egypt and settled on the whole country of Egypt. Such a dense swarm of locusts has never been before, nor ever will be again. They covered the face of the whole land, so that the land was dark. green thing remains. When the tree will plant, through all the land of Egypt.
All right, so a way to think through this part of the process on the parental level. Have you ever told your kids or been told by your parents no? Like I said before, that's the first word that a lot of kids learn is no. Was that enough, that one no? One no, did that work? One no was good for all time. It was like the universal nuclear no, and you never had to use it again. Now, for whatever reason, it's exploratory. It's the kids don't realize that this no was actually a no for all time. You don't. They ask that no again, right? And then you say, they ask the same question, no. And you say, no again. No again, no again, and no again, and you keep saying no. That's a normal parenting process. It's a normal leadership process. It's a normal life process. Does it wear you out? Emotionally and humanly, in the sense of how we tend to respond, we tend to escalate our no process. The initial firm, straight no is nice and calm. No. Question gets asked again, are we always gentle with the third no and the 12th no? What happens often is our body posture changes. You know, we go from to kind of puff ourselves up until the visual changes. We turn on the magic stink eye. You know, and that no becomes no. And then it becomes all the other possible combinations of N and O we can combine in a sentence. Until it sticks. And then we look back at the no train that's behind us, and we wonder how we can shorten the journey. How can we make the first no have the weight of the 10th no? I don't have the answer to that, because I don't necessarily think it always works that way. Because it's not a switch. We see that here. Pharaoh's saying no to God, and God's saying no to Pharaoh over and over again. Which one wins? God does. In the parental side of things, we need to be cautious and careful to not let no eventually turn into yes. Because then you both lose. For whatever good reason, it was good to say no the first time, it's still good the 10th time. And the reason I bring this up right here is because some of the court of Pharaoh is cracking under the pressure of the wall of God. Beginning to see this is not a good plan. And Israel is seeing the steadfastness of God. They're getting a chance to understand who God is and where He comes from and what His center place is and the consistency of who He is as a people. And Moses is seeing that. And Pharaoh and Aaron, they're seeing that too. And a generation will rise from the ashes of these events that really knows of the trustworthiness of God. Really understands. So catching that right here on a physical level, we can see it in the parental plane, helps us understand it right here. God already knows that Pharaoh's never going to let go. So his nose, the Pharaoh, aren't going to give up. They're going to keep back. Nope. Mm-mm. I'm not giving in to you. But it seems like reasonable requests. Well, yeah, just go worship a little bit. What would have been the outcome for Israel? Had Moses agreed to the parley, everybody loses. Everybody loses. Pharaoh loses. Moses loses. Israel loses. Just kind of saucing it through the whole mixture there and seeing those bits and pieces help us catch it. And I think we can understand it on the parental plane. Now we have a different and maybe a richer picture to what's going on here as a teaching tool. To understand the circumstance too. Question, Sims, do you have something? Your hand was rising. Did I push it down with my own answer to the question? Or?
No.
Okay. Save it for later. You can tell me afterwards. Maybe I'll remember. Text continues. This is verses 16 through 20. It's the last part of this segment. Then Pharaoh hastily called Moses and Aaron and said, I have sinned against the Lord your God, and against you. Now therefore forgive my sin. Please, only this once. And plead with the Lord your God only to remove this death from me. So he went out from Pharaoh and pleaded with the Lord. Pause on the text right there. Does Moses have any reason at all to trust Pharaoh? Actually, he has none. Does he have a history of half-hearted, half-intended, temporary, please forgive me? But it sounds sincere, doesn't it? And the evidence that's around there indicates these are all factual things. Learning point for us is that classic phrase, did not judge the book by its cover, and Moses doesn't. God, the plan of God goes forward, and he goes and pleads to God for it. In spite of the callousness of our own hearts, that we sometimes get in these same circumstances, we say, he's not going to change. Because I'm sure you've probably encountered some level of that in your life, either directed to you or someone took to you, told you, and said, you're not going to change. The words may not have been spoken, but the actions were there, or you've treated someone that way. Well, with that company, they're not going to warranty this project. It's not a warranty. They're not going to do that. They're not going to do the right thing. They never do. And then they do. You know, that's a little catching point here, that Moses, this Moses, not the Moses who struck down the Egyptian, not the Moses who was the shepherd, but the Moses who now serves at the full intent of God. Text continues again now, verse 19. And the Lord turned the wind into a very strong west wind and lifted the locusts and drove them into the Red Sea. Don't forget that connection there about being driven into the Red Sea. Not a single locust was left in all the country of Egypt. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the people of Israel go. So, the lever is still there. The lever of the Lord is still pressing down on Pharaoh and Egypt. But the request of the Pharaoh was still answered by God. Get the death out. I have sinned. It was specifically answered, too. They're all gone. But did Pharaoh fully change? No. The lever hardened. If Pharaoh would wise up, he would just step out from underneath the lever and let God push it all the way down. But the weight of God keeps pushing down on his heart, and he's unwilling to let go. Whatever it is he's holding to, he's clinging to, was of more value to him than the respite from this constant push of God, this constant pressure that's dropping upon them, this attitude and circumstance that says, oh, it's always going to, you know, there's always something that I want, and yet God has a plan. Verse 21, the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt. A darkness to be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand toward heaven, and there was pitch darkness. In all the land of Egypt, 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days, but all the people of Israel had light where they lived. Just think about, you know, the way in which God's miraculous endeavors lay out. They go from having everything, including Israel, to the locusts taking everything. Can't even see their family. Can't see one another. This is one of the miracles, I think, in some ways, that it's the hardest for me to conceptualize. To be in that circumstance where it's so pitched black that you don't even get out of bed. And the full impact of that level of change. Because it notably says this, that it's not just the sun is covered. No light at all. That includes the inside of spaces. That includes the use of artificial sources of light. None. But where's light? They could, if they had the wherewithal or the ability of the hearts, wander to the light.
But they didn't even begin to do that.
And again, it's one of those things that, you know, I'll get to that in a second, where I always wonder what it's like on the state line, on the dividing mark
between
where light is and where no light
exists. They summon Moses.
Somehow there's a risk taker or two amongst them. But again, you think about how all that works out. And the power of God displayed is that now, in essence, as far as they can perceive at this point, everything's gone from them. But Israel is safe. Israel is home. A quick catch and a quick reminder is that God, from this point forward, will lever up the use of light and dark as storytelling methods to teach us about God. To the extent where when we get to the New Testament, all the way over here, we get to the letters of God, to the Gospels, to the revealing and text of Revelation, Jesus says, I am the light. In God, there is no darkness. You go all the way back to the plagues, the answer is, who is God? Go right here. Whole letter of Colossians, the whole idea of Ephesians, when you put on the new, the whole transformative relationship between whom you were and whom God is making you become. Well, go back here. Darkness. Light. I mean, you just think about that whole picture. It's all from here. Why study the Old Testament? There's a quick plug for the Old Testament. So you understand. Paul says it was your tutor. Christ. You ever need a tutor before? All the time. Well, here's a good example of the Old Testament is the tutor to understand the new. All right, so you've got that big picture. The text continues, catching in verse 24. Then Pharaoh called Moses and said, go serve the Lord. Your little ones also may go with you. Only let your flocks and your herds remain. But Moses said, you must let us have sacrifices and burnt offerings, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Our livestock also must go with us. Not a hoof shall be left behind. For we must take of them to serve the Lord our God, and we do not know with what we must serve the Lord until we get there. The Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let them go. Then Pharaoh said to him, go away from me. Take care never to see my face again. For on the day you see my face, you shall die. Moses said, as you say, I will not see your face again. That's foreshadowing on the literary side, by the way. If you're looking at the technical aspect of how God teaches, he foreshadows the future. But here, are flocks and herds a big deal?
Yeah.
It's everything. But not always for the reasons that we think they are. Moses gives us the key one. God has said, go worship, but he has not told me what to do. And so we have to be prepared. And so that helps us understand that whatever it is that God told beyond the Scripture's record, Moses, in his conversational role as a spokesperson for God, understood that all of Israel meant all of Israel. Adults. Kids, moms, dads, grandpas, little ones, newborns, to the oldest, and the flocks and herds. All of Israel actually meant all of Israel. And the application then is we're ready to worship however God needs us to worship. The stubbornness of Pharaoh is, you come back to see me again, of the protection of God that's already been afforded to him. Pharaoh's saying, spear's coming up on you, you come back. Yeah. Well, Pharaoh is clinging to every last chance he thinks he might have to stay in charge, to hold on, to be the man, to be the Pharaoh, to be the king, to be the boss, to be the God on earth. That's where he sees himself. And the lever of God is pushing deeper and deeper down. And Israel is going to pop free. And it's going to tear up the mess behind it because of the stubborn path. One more thing to catch. We've only got about 4 minutes, so we can't really introduce and aren't going to really catch into chapter 11 anyway, time-wise, because it's a rich chapter, and I want to give it more space. we've made intentional connections to the story of God dealing with Moses and Pharaoh to make it personal to how our own hearts respond to the message of God. Think through that with each of these plagues, each of these blessings, because there's blessings to Israel and there's potential blessings to Egypt offered in all of this conversation. When we think about the writer of Hebrews who tells us about the way in which God disciplines as connected to our earthly fathers, I could probably survey most adult males in the United States, and for the majority of the adults 40 and up, they could all tell me the width of their dad's belts. Generationally, it's going to be wide or thin, but you remember. All right? And then God tells us that that discipline was for our good, and we learn that eventually. God's discipline is for our good. Okay, now back to the plagues. God's disciplining His creation at this point. The discipline that was brought down on Egypt was for their good. And the discipline, because the plagues went to Israel too, was for their good. But does it feel good in the moment? That's the application of Hebrews. Not at all. In fact, it hurts both the father and the child. There's a lot. But then you go back and you go, I'm actually going to thank you for it because I didn't do the dumb thing that I did again, and it would have been worse. So back into the crucible of these plagues, these conversations with God and His people that are taking place here. It's a disciplining moment. We can allow that to be discipline only for Egypt and Israel. Or as God intended, that can be discipline for you and me. And we can maybe learn to be less stubborn in the face of God. We can be more compassionate. Learn to lead better through these opportunities and circumstances. I think it's 43. I didn't hear the first bell. So, Michael, did you get the bell out there for the other classes? Okay, good. I always forget the timing. That's just all about there. So, trying to make sure we don't have hordes knocking at the door. So, in that bigger picture, that crucible, that opportunity to see the pressure of God's discipline pouring down on us. Don't shy away from it. Allow God's discipline to form you into what God needs you to be, rather than fighting it back against the rip, against the belt, against the paddle, against the prodding. We don't want to be Pharaoh. We want to be Moses. And we can. We can actually be like Moses. It's not that he's up here and we're down here. That he's close to God, and we need to get closer to him too. And that's kind of the way to look at these illustrative events, is to think, well, how can we get closer to that? Moses' stubbornness is the only thing that kept him out. Frustration is the only thing that kept him out of the promised land. You know, I'm not going to, here's your water. Instead of just following what God said. That's it for our class this morning. We'll be looking into the 11th chapter for our next 3 days. There's more allegories and bits.